Hello, guys, and welcome to episode 2 of the Wasta podcast. I want to introduce the infamous Nader Sabri. I'm sure you've probably come across his profile on LinkedIn or listened into one of his talks or even attended an event where he's done some public speaking. Before I let Nader introduce himself, I think I'm going to do something new and explain to our listeners how I met the guest. So I actually slid into Nader's DMs on LinkedIn, and I think this is common amongst how people network. I slid in to tell Nader about my business and to get him to be one of the early adopters. Nader did sign up, but we didn't actually introduce him to anyone. It's never too late, because I think we've actually made a match to Nader actually, but there's more to come. And after about, I think, 6 months of having each other on LinkedIn, I reintroduced myself on LinkedIn to ask him some questions. And then I asked him to be part of my podcast. So Nader, thank you very much for being part of the podcast. And I'd love for you to introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you. No, thank you first off for the invitation, and thank you for introducing me to your new product. I think that plays a really important role in greasing the wheels in the ecosystem, especially when it comes to some of the things that are really important but difficult to find tools to actually solve. And I think that you guys play a really important role in that. So I found that just to be very, very interesting. As for background, I specialize in the sciences of growth, and that really surprises people when they first meet me or hear about what I do. And I tell them that, well, you know, growth is a science, and they're kind of like, whoa, that's news to me. They probably heard of something like growth hacking in the past, or they're exploring it or trying to figure it out. And it's a relatively new practice in the sense of it being organized as a practice, but has actually been practiced for over 50 years, which surprises people, because most people believe that growth or growth hacking is something that's relevant to startups and tech startups only, or unicorns. Unicorns are the best, obviously, at doing this. And so there's this connotation that it's only for, you know, tech startups, which is actually not true. So in if you don't mind, in my first book here, which is a global bestseller, Ready, Set, Growth Hack, this is a blueprint that teaches people exponential growth. And we look at examples that go 50 years back by traditional companies like McDonald's, companies in the 70s and 80s like Federal Express. We look at companies like Columbia House, for example, the inventors of the negative option billing model, which is actually the birth point of Netflix business model, which sounds weird to people, but we explain the science behind these business models and how they relate to actual growth. So the last, through way of introduction, for the last 25 plus years, I've been building different type of organizations, everything from startup companies, unicorns, working with Fortune 1000s, Fortune 500s, and governments. And it all relates to the idea of growth. So whether it come from a strategy side or an innovation side, at the end, the purpose of the existence of an organization and the purpose of the existence of an individual in an organization is one reason and one reason only, and that's growth. That may sound kind of monotoned if you just listen to it as a soundbite on its own. Yeah. But in all reality, that is actually the main reason. And the sooner and faster you realize that and understand the mechanics behind that, you'll start to experience a different form of success and a different form of seeing the world around you. Yeah. And given sort of the COVID-19 situation and the pandemic, and if you look at some of my earlier talks, it's something called the talent explosion. And it's one of the early forms of prediction of what is now coined as the Great Resignation. And the latest numbers are something like, I think, 20 million people every month are quitting their jobs and then going back to work and outright exploring more meaningful ways of making a living and trying to engage in solving some of the world's more difficult problems that are more meaningful rather than just being in a corporate job. And this presents a significant amount of growth, put aside the kind of political landscape and context of what's happening right now, the way that companies and people are going to need to grow starting today, is very different than yesterday, and it's going to be very different to what will happen tomorrow. But the way we look at it today will pave the way for the way that we'll be growing and building organizations for the future. Yeah. So I've been doing this, again, like I said, across the board for many organizations. I work with organizations like NASA, Google, Microsoft, DHL, on a numerous level of different things, but they all will come to the conclusion of exponential growth.
Yeah. Yeah. If you had to, I've just finished reading a book which is synonymous to a lot of founders, which is called the Mum's Test. And the Mum's Test is all about explaining to your customers what you exactly do, mostly from a sales perspective. But if you had to sum up growth and the elements around growth to, you know, someone who's just coming out of the corporate world or someone who's very not so familiar with the startup ecosystem, how would you explain it in like one sentence if you could do that?
Well, the way I explained growth hacking in the first book, and it kind of disrupted the space, because the typical definition, if you were to just kind of Google it or read some of the definitions before I published, they were very technical definitions. But I define it in a very simple way, and I call it disproportionate results. And that's where the growth sciences are. And the way to explain that in a really simple way is, imagine you put in one unit of effort. Four units of effort, and you get one unit of results. And on the other side, you put in one unit of effort, but you get four units of results. And in the middle, that transition point is growth hacking. That's where the science of growth comes in, where essentially I'll know how to use less resources to get much more disproportionate results. Now, for first-time founders who hear this, this is like magic to their ears. They're like, man, I can pull off a whole bunch of stuff with nothing. Okay, so that's not true. Let me just be very clear with that. That's not true. You will always need resources, but you'd be surprised that you may not need as much as you need, but you'll always need a sufficient amount of resources to be able to pull off that process. And the type of organizations that have mastered this, about 98% of unicorns use growth hacking at the core of their model. And that's why they're unicorns. Whereas, you know, Fortune 1000s, only 1.5% of them, which are like a handful, are actually exploring and developing growth hacking methods within their organizations. 21% of existing startups, and roughly half of that when it comes to just corporates, who are, again, exploring and trying to develop growth and growth hacking into their organizations. And there's a huge debate globally as well. I'll be talking about it in May and June and July in the US and Canada. So it's a massive wave of questioning happening at the moment, for very good reason, around the future of organizational structures. Because what has been seen is your typical structure that you develop today, whether it be a corporate or a startup, actually is not ready for the world that we've entered and are about to work with. And in my training, I talk a lot about, you know, the difference between a unicorn structure and that of a typical corporate or a startup. And there's a science behind this. And there's a difference between how an organization that is genuinely ready for the future and actually can grow is structured and the systems and strategies that they use versus organizations that have a legacy. And sometimes startup founders naturally have inherent legacy without knowing it. And that's purely because they either are coming from a corporate environment, or they've read too much into corporate methods, or reading management theories that they may believe are up to date, but are not. They may also be getting some very outdated advice. And so they're structuring things in ways that doesn't enable their growth. Too many processes, too many layers, not enough of what needs to happen in order to give the priority and energy to the things that need to happen in an organization for growth. So these are some of the things that are happening right now as we speak globally, as major debates and things in transition as we speak.
Yeah. Well, one thing we found is when speaking to startups, because I think I mentioned to you when we previously spoke that because we're a community of founders, VCs, angels, and people who are coming out of corporates to start their own venture, there's a massive information gap between what the market knows and what the market needs to know to get to validating their business and then scaling it up. The first thing that people say to me is automation, automate it. Automate everything. Email marketing, automate it. Lead generation, get a couple of guys in India or Turkey or Egypt to just sit there and just track everything off LinkedIn and then just automate that into MailChimp and then just send it out to 100,000 people. Boom, growth hacking 101 finished. And I'm just going to wait, go for tea, watch the football, and then everyone's going to sink in and become customers. I think there is a massive gap in knowledge gap that, and I'm learning still as a founder of a community tech product, that acquiring customers and getting good leads through elements of growth hacking. And we will go through the different techniques that we've done. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on awesome. What you've done on similar products, because not all business is the same. There's a massive information gap. Have you also seen that as well when you're working with some of
your clients? There's a reason behind that. And I'll kind of explain to you. So I'll respond to kind of your question and comment in a few ways. So I'll start with the first part about entrepreneurship and people coming into entrepreneurship from a corporate environment. And the second part is outreach, which is what you're talking about. So the first part when it comes to entrepreneurs, so what a lot of people don't realize is there's two types of entrepreneurs. There's voluntary and non-voluntary entrepreneurs. And this is probably the first time for a lot of you people tuning in that to come across this terminology, and I'm going to make it just really simple. But what happens is a voluntary entrepreneur is somebody who essentially is just chooses to be an entrepreneur. A non-voluntary entrepreneur is somebody who's coming most of the time from a corporate environment, who's become redundant, and through non-voluntary means have become an entrepreneur. The two streams and two mindsets and the two thinking are not the same. And so entrepreneurs that come out of a corporate environment who are in a non-voluntary situation and enter entrepreneurship actually have very little resources and support to help them, because their segment is not well understood. And in fact, it's not well defined. And I've had people in my 10-day growth hacking challenge, one of them, he's tackling this and he didn't realize it. And I said, you need to be very clear that there are, you know, the two types of entrepreneurs, and you need to tackle them very differently. They think differently, they work differently, and they come from completely different environments. Although they're all classified as just under the term entrepreneurs, they're not the same thing. So to address that initial point. Your second point is very interesting, because with the outreach. So the thing about outreach and these types of growth hacks that you just mentioned, so these are what are called white hat growth hacking, and white hat growth hacking are essentially techniques that are readily available. So if I Google it, like how to grow my outreach on LinkedIn or whatever it might be. So if I can Google it, and the rule of thumb is if I can Google it, I can find it. It most likely doesn't work. And that's where the problems start for many people entering the growth hacking space. And the reason behind that is the history of growth hacking comes from a very shady, dark background, actually. Okay. And its essence was built in highly secretive methodologies that could be in some cases illegal or on the borderlines of being illegal. So the way we look at it and the way we define it in my book and the way I describe it, just to be very clear to people, is there's white hat, grayscale, and black hat. Okay. And black hat is when you cross the lines, there's illegal activity, immoral, unethical activity. And I don't promote that. Anyone in my, you know, my communities, everyone does that. I kick them out. We don't do that kind of stuff. On the other side, the white hat, none of that stuff is potent. It's not going to work. What's in the middle is the grayscale. And then the darker side of the grayscale, which doesn't mean illegal or immoral or any of those activities. These are actually secrets. So we have, I run something called Growth Labs. I don't know if you know about it, but essentially it's AI that we use to measure growth experiments and to look at how those results have worked. And one of the things that we measure is the life cycle of a growth hack, where it could originate in black hat activities and work its way to white hat activities. And the way we classify it is, you know, top secret, secret, classified, and then declassified. So if I was able to do what you're talking about and find it by Google, that's a declassified growth hack, and most likely not to work. So the biggest, best, and most effective important growth hacks in the world are top secret. Nobody will ever tell you them. And the reason being is that the longer they stay secret, the more potent they are. And this is something that's just known in the growth hacking world. Between growth hackers at high levels, there'll be an exchange of ideas and ways of enhancing these, but that would still be done in highly confidential, highly secretive circles, because the minute that they go into the open, just like you mentioned, let me tap into LinkedIn and do this, and LinkedIn will automatically shut these things down. And in many ways, People feel that they're entitled to take this data, but in all reality, it's actually, well, legally, it's not allowed. Heads up on that. The second part, it's not fair to the platform, right? So the platform is consistently changing its algorithm, not just to optimize, obviously, for their own benefit, but to protect themselves from people who do things that are not correct. Now, the only way for that to be detected is if 50,000 people are doing the same thing at the same time. But if there's only a few people doing it and it wasn't detected, then it wouldn't be in the interest of those growth hackers to share those secrets with the general public.
Interesting. That's super interesting. Yeah. And you've worked all around the world. I see you've worked in Asia, in the Middle East, in the US. Do you think certain growth hacks are susceptible or more susceptible when you're using certain techniques in different geographies?
It can be. I mean, I look at more of on a broader level, but I agree with you that there are places that are more, let's say, conducive to growth hacking. Okay. So the culture around growth hacking and understand. So I was on a conversation last night. A major recruitment firm in the UK has recognized that there's only very few growth hackers in the world. In fact, the last count we did, which was 2 years ago, there's only about 5,000 growth hackers globally. And if you go to Silicon Valley, it is a well-known quote by many top people that it is harder to hire a growth hacker than it is to hire a CEO for a startup company. And it's true. So this recruitment company knows this. And so they're struggling, like, where are we going to find the talent for this future growth? So there's a massive gap in the growth sciences overall, let alone in the area of growth hacking. But the people who recognize it are in more sophisticated markets, and they are working to do something about it. Different places are dealing with it in different ways. In the Middle East in general, it's a relatively new concept. They're not familiar with it. One of the biggest problems in the Middle East, everyone thinks everything should be for free or very low cost. And that's a huge barrier, because in Asia and in the US, I can tell you that major dollars go into the development of highly sophisticated growth hacks that can obviously exponentially bring massive results. That kind of culture doesn't exist here. It's relatively, let's just be fair, it's relatively non-existent.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think obviously because I am the community manager of this network, we're seeing more people looking for growth marketing, growth managers, community managers, and there seems a little bit more of a transparency or inwards looking from like the US culture, bringing that into the Middle East. But yes, the question I'm thinking to myself is that, is the market mature enough for these people to come in and to roll out these hacks, whatever these hacks are? And my question to you is, what does a growth hacker actually do? Like, what is their job? Like, do they sit on LinkedIn every day and trying to run bots? Are they trying to look at customer surveys, getting that information back and trying to run algorithms and seeing how they can create better penetration? Are they speaking one-on-one and hacking one customer at a time? What do these growth hackers actually do?
Like, yeah. What are they? No, it's a really good question. So I'll kind of break it down for you. We'll start with the very first part here. So in my world, there's no such thing as a growth marketer or a growth community person. And it goes back to the structures I was talking to you about. So fundamentally, the problem here is So where growth hacking is today in the future of it is what we call cross-functional growth hacking. Cross-functional growth hacking essentially means that it's not subject to a specific function, and it should never be. And that's where the unicorns who mastered growth hacking learned the hard way and actually did very well. So what they understood was that growth supersedes a function. So growth should not be within marketing. And many people mistakenly will classify growth hacking as a marketing activity, which it is not. In that case, it becomes non-cross-functional and it becomes linear, and it's only stuck within a certain function. And that's why it doesn't work. In this region, you'll see a lot of that. Whereas in more developed areas where they understand growth hacking, growth actually would sit under leadership, and everything in an organization would actually be subservient to growth. And I'll give you a practical example. So let's say today in your business, you go hire some guy to do community growth, okay? And so here you go, you put a lot of effort into your community. But what happens is you put all your efforts into the community, but you've not actually balanced your resources to work with, your operations, your customer service, your market, whatever else that you're doing. And so what happens is you get this overdeveloped situation where you have an imbalance. And so it's not cross-functional, it's just monofunctional. And a monofunctional organization or a monofunctional approach has never worked. And that's usually people who fall into those traps or either lack experience or poorly guided or just haven't failed yet to see this or haven't failed enough even sometimes to see this. So that brings us to the question that you asked is what does a growth hacker do? Now, there are different levels of growth hackers, of course, but in essence, a growth hacker looks over the whole growth of the organization, irrelevant to function, meaning whatever function reports, let's say, to a growth unit or a growth leader. And by the way, in my opinion, and that I developed this with my clients, is the number one growth hacker in the organization has to be the principal owner of the business, actually. It should be the CEO or the founder or the co-founders, because at the end, nobody really cares about your organization and its growth more than you. If you think you're going to outsource it, good luck. If you think you're going to hire a few people who are just going to do that, good luck. They're going to learn and move on. And I see this happen to my clients and people in my challenge all the time, where they just don't take growth seriously and they look at it as just an independent, isolated function, which it is not. And that's where the failure comes in. So a really good growth hacker is somebody who's able to overlook all these functions, and he or she is able to determine if that function is serving growth or not serving growth. If it is serving growth, how do you optimize it and get more out of it? If it's not serving growth, what do you do to fix it? If it still doesn't work, get rid of it. And what do you replace it with? So this is a very difficult decision-making cycle. I'm making it sound really simple. But in an organizational situation where something is just not serving growth, people just want to keep everything kind of running like a fruit salad. Yeah. They want all the fruits in there. But sometimes not all the fruits are serving you very well. So you'll have to remove the fruit that doesn't work. And even at the end, if you're left with one fruit and it's no longer a fruit salad, then but it works and it gets the growth that you need and where you're going, then ultimately that's all you need. And that's a very different form of thinking. And the starting point of a really good growth hacker is not the technical skills. In fact, it's the mindset. So the mindset is what governs culture, it governs the tools that are being used, even governs the tools that are being created, and eventually the experiments. So experiments are the key, let's say, call it the heart of growth hacking. And that's where the magic happens, right? And there's a lot of, you know, a lot goes behind this. So in my second book here, which is Growth Thinking, and in my 10-day growth hacking challenge, that's exactly what we do. And this method is being used at universities like Harvard, Stanford. It's not part of their curriculum, but it is being used by students and professors as a methodology, because there isn't anything that exists in the area of growth sciences officially as a methodology. And the reason that that's important was that you would start running growth hacks and you would try to communicate, for example, with other growth hackers, and they wouldn't know what you're talking about. There would be elements, you'd understand each other, but there was no common language that brings everybody together. So a really good methodology, and this is a design methodology, so it's very easy actually, brings that communications and capability to execute very quickly in a very low cost way in one place. And once you're able to do that, you're then able to scale. Okay, so there's this what's called the growth cycle. And I talk about that in my training, in my talks, in my other books. And it's funny because I was doing a talk actually last week. And one of the people at the talk in the audience, she was in the very last part of the cycle and she didn't understand the cycle. When she saw it, she's like, oh my God, I'm at the very end. And I said, that's where the highest failure point is. It's at the very end of the cycle. And she just kind of broke open, like, here's what we're having and the problems. And everybody in the audience was like, yo, we're about to hit this part. And we didn't recognize that there was a cycle. And I was like, here's the reasons why it fails, because you can succeed all the way up to that one single point, and then it just stops working. And then people don't understand why, what happened. And it relates a lot to some of the things you just pointed out earlier about automation. So, and we had a really interesting conversation actually yesterday, another event where everybody is pushing towards artificial intelligence, automation. And in all reality, there is no 100% automated organization on the planet. Okay. And there are four reasons for this. Now, it doesn't mean that automation is wrong. Doesn't mean it doesn't work. The reality is, and we've seen this in the legal business with some of my clients, as the legal industry is being disrupted and is trying to use artificial intelligence, with the maximum usage of artificial intelligence, autonomous decision-making, data analytics, only 60% of a legal entity, or it's not an entity, sorry, but a legal organization like a law firm can actually be automated. Now, 60% is a lot, actually. It may not sound like much to you, but that's a lot. And the amount of savings and exponential growth that can happen out of that is phenomenal. But then people will be like, well, what about the remaining 40%? I mean, like, hello, I mean, can't we automate the rest of that? And the short answer is yes, you can. But what people fail to realize is that, especially in the professional services industry, and this applies to many industries, is the craftsmanship of a human being cannot be replicated, at least not till today, by artificial intelligence. And craftsmanship means creativity, intuition, ability to see things that others would not be able to see. Those kinds of things a computer cannot replicate. No matter what kind of movies you're watching or whoever you're reading, it's not there yet. So you need to recognize what we call these kinds of, I mean, we look in my book, we're talking about three types of automation: non-automation, semi-automation, and automation, full automation. Most of organizations will be in the semi-automation space, and the semi-automation space is all about being able to optimize, and there are different models on how to optimize it and keep increasing the automation, but you'll never really reach 100% automation.
Yeah, I think you're so right there, because our first startup failed. We created the LinkedIn for construction for the Middle East market. Two massive lessons learned for us, or three, or actually many lessons learned. We spent way too much money on trying to figure out this correlation of data and trying to automate everything and being like, hey, we'll just automate the CV and automate the job description. We can just match everyone. It will be kumbaya. Everything will be great. And then we realized that the data that was coming in is forever changing because people's experience are continuously changing. In which case, if people don't actively update their profiles, then you're going to get matched with the wrong job description. And if the job description isn't created in the way that it's not been written down by the person who's written it, then you're going to be matched with the wrong person. And then you're only as good as the match that the automation makes. And then video interviews are being automated with these AI bots to say, if you're smiling, then you're lying. Yep. And if your eyes are big, then, you know, you might be telling the truth. And you're like, there's no way of taking that human touch out of the process to actually find the right candidate. We quickly learned that yes, there are platforms out there which do it, but, you know, the human element of it, you need them at different touch points to regulate or to monitor the work that's been done by the machine, and no human can be replicated by the data sets. And that's basically what we learn. In terms of what you said prior to that, for me, because you're talking about growth hacking and how it all kind of fits together, I'm churning that as a founder and thinking right now that growth hacking was my next hire. It was like, we're trying to get our community, we're about 1,000 strong. We need to get to 10,000 because that's one of our metrics. 10,000 active users in 12 months. Okay, my key hire is going to be growth marketing. For me, this looked like everyone around the green button. This guy was going to come get hired and press the green button. The rocket goes up.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
10,000 users, guys. I'm going to go to all my VCs and say, guys, we had a chat last week. We got this guy on board. We got 10,000 users and we're ready for our Series A. Yep. That's what in my head, and this is what most founders will see, is once I get that check, once I get that metrics, once I get the community manager, growth manager, done, exit, we're going to NASDAQ, guys, bring your friends and family. And the thing is, this is the harsh reality that now I'm thinking is I need to build better infrastructure within my structure to say that if someone in growth comes in, that we're all around the table talking about if growth goes up by 20x, will we be able to create retention in our users? Will we be able to cater for the supply of people coming in and actually suffice demand? Because if we don't, losing a customer is actually worse off than actually attracting more people, and actually retaining 100%. People in growth is an art. So growth and retention need to go hand in hand, and your business needs to be able to sustain the level of growth. Because for us, we've got a wait list. And what we do is, instead of getting the people to wait on the wait list, we ask them to do different things, you know, follow our social media, add our Telegram channel. So we keep them activated within this ecosystem that we've created, but we can only run as fast as the systems that are making the connections, which is why we have to verify them slowly. So there's an element of understanding that all parties, which you alluded to about the CEO owning that process, because they will know how, you know, the changes and variations of inputs coming into the business will have an effect on the output. When you are mentoring, when you are speaking to your clients Do you almost get them to envision what the outcome is first, and then say, like, what is it? What does this course look like? Or what do you want to get out of it? And then try to work backwards. Is that one of the tools that you use?
As a typical consulting process, that would be the answer, but this is not a typical consulting approach. So ultimately, what happens is the true growth comes from the unseen, actually, or the unknown. And the reality is that, so I have clients that come like, hey, let's put a KPI. And I said, why would you limit yourself from the beginning? You see, the mindset from the beginning is already limited, okay? It's limited because you've been conditioned like this. So it's not like you don't have the ability to think without limitation. It's that you've been ingrained into this system in which, like, KPIs have got to be there. We got to define all this in advance. We need to have a vision. Actually, that's all rubbish. You don't need any of that. In all truth, you don't need any of that. That's not how these unicorns built themselves. If you go to them and tell them, like, hey, did you see everything in advance? They'll tell you, no, we didn't. In all truth, they'll tell you, no, we didn't. You have to experiment to find these and unlock these unseen and unknown areas. And that's how these things actually happen. So that's why when you look at a high growth company and you look at their history and all the pivot points that they had, you kind of like step back and you're stunned and you're kind of like, this is, you know, it's like an artistic masterpiece. Like, where did this all come from? It looks like magic to most people. In fact, there's no magic behind it. There's a science in how this happened. But they didn't start by defining it, because you see, the problem here is if you take a look at business plans, for example, like in the 90s, when we used to write business plans to go raise money, you'd have a whole bunch of assumptions and everybody would be talking about the assumptions. That's how you'd raise money. 99% of those assumptions would never even happen. They wouldn't even happen the way you think they are. Nowadays, you go do a pitch deck and you've got this idea. And again, you'll be working with assumptions, but the same thing still exists. 99% of the assumptions will prove to be incorrect. Okay. The problem with that thinking, because you've been conditioned like that, is ego starts to come into play that, oh my God, we need to stick to our plan. Our plan is definitely going to work. We have to make like these minor adjustments, but that plan is going to work. Okay. You reach a point where the plan or that strategy doesn't work. And it doesn't work because you're not smart. It doesn't work because you made a commitment. It doesn't work because of the resource. It doesn't work because of the mindset. Okay. Why? Okay. You need to be open to things that you don't know, right? That's where the growth is, right? So if I knew everything and I had everything planned out in my business plan, my pitch deck was perfect, and it was just like what you said, press the green button and the rocket takes off. Well, that's a beautiful world to live in, but that's not reality. That is not how it works. You're going down this path to build Wusta, right? Along the way, you're going to run some growth experiments and you're going to discover something that's going to throw you off your feet, okay? And what's going to happen is you have two ways of responding to it. You either like, dude, something is wrong, I'm sticking to my plan, or something else has been introduced that could potentially reintroduce a whole bunch of different things to us. We need to explore it. And there's different ways. I mean, in here, we talk about how to do this, okay? And as you go down that path, what happens is you start to actually build it with time. So it's not actually like an actual strategy in full, like this is exactly going to happen on this date. Yes, you need to have milestones. Yes, you'll need to have some project plans because you need a roadmap to move forward. That you definitely need. However, it cannot be in so much detail that everything is pre-planned to a point that you know exactly what's going to happen, because the reality is you don't know. And if you get stuck in that thinking, you will not grow.
Yeah.
Now, there's another aspect to this. I know people are probably thinking, but you know, when I go to investors, they want that. Well, investors haven't necessarily always been the greatest tool for growth. Sorry to tell you, right? There are different levels of different type of investors. And in one of my talks, I had some of them audience. They're talking about, they have a business model where they need investors to supplement the growth because they're not after profitable customers. They're after the usership, right? And I told them, like, listen, that's not a business model that doesn't work. It works. It just doesn't work in this Middle East region. You need to be with highly sophisticated venture capitalists who have the absorption power and mindset to understand that they're just going to keep spending until you build up this massive usership, and the usership must change behavior, right? If it doesn't change behavior, there's no money to be made, right? If the behavior stays the same and you got like a million users, nothing has been accomplished, right? If you look at Amazon, and that was the example they used, I said, what happened is Amazon changed people's behavior. They changed people's behavior from rather going to an actual bricks and mortar store to going online and getting what they want. And then they started perfecting that experience by giving recommendations, by giving you better prices, by being able to filter through what you want by introducing relevant products that you didn't think of, and on and on and on. So the experience became better, right? And so because of that, the change in behavior is where the money is. It's not because they got a million users.
That's super interesting, because when I was thinking about growth, I was thinking about how to acquire as many users and try to retain them by just giving them what they want, which was connecting them up with VCs or angels, etc. And one of my biggest, I wouldn't say it was a lesson learned. It wasn't a bad decision. It was a lesson learned. My decision was, who has got the biggest community in the Middle East? And most of these people are accelerator programs. They're people who are doing incubations, co-working spaces. So I spent a long time going drafting legal documents to go in with these agreements, these collaborative agreements with, hey, like Wasta and us could be partners and you promote us and I promote you and it'll be kumbaya again. And we will go on to their lead generation emails and it'll go out to 50,000 customers. And we only need 10% of those 50,000 to get them acquired, and then do that with five or six partners, and then we'll just tick a box. And I was thinking, this is definitely going to work. I know a lot of people, some of these guys that from these managerial roles are using Wasta. And I went out there and I was like, hey, I'm from Wasta, sign the contract, we'll get access to your community. And a matter of fact, it just didn't work. And there was so much excitement from my side, but when they were like, actually, it's not going to work for us, I was like, damn. So if I can't actually get these guys to sign up, then this is actually business failure. Because I can't actually acquire customers. I can't actually move forward because I've hit a threshold of X hundred people. To get beyond that, I'm thinking, damn, I can't do this. And then a good friend of mine, I'm going to mention his name, Abe. Shout out to Abe, SecSec, great guy from Rainmaker. He introduced me to this book called The Hook. And I read The Hook. And I don't know, have you read The Hook before?
Yeah.
The Hook. And it was all about behavior. And then my entire mindset from product building, growth, how I, you know, approach problems completely flipped to what you mentioned, which was behavior. Then we started looking, because we're currently building our app, we're looking at behavior of customers. And we realized, and we picked up one of the biggest pain points with our customers, and that was organizing a time to meet. Because people were putting meeting times at the back of their diary and be like, oh, if I meet him, I meet him. If I meet her, I'll meet her. But the matter of fact that people weren't meeting because they couldn't agree the time, irrespective if they had Calendly or not, because it wasn't at the top of their mind, because their behavior was driving their decision making. And so what we created, which we're seeing, what we hopefully will be able to see, because we're going to be testing this hypothesis, is something called Wasta time, which basically means that at the outset for your calendar, we block out a time, and that's your Wasta time, which we're hoping, based on feedback that we received so far, will be a growth hack for more people to use it, for more retention to happen, and for us to take out that problem where people are going back and forth. On average, it takes 7 emails in our community to organize a meet, in which case 40% of people dropped off because there were too many emails going forth.
You got to figure that out. Another
20% of that weren't responding because the emails went straight into junk, in which case people didn't even know that there was a match. So having that element of changing behavior, and we're making tweaks on this, and using like our Telegram channel and other ways of testing that out to find out whether we can improve ourselves. But behavior, as you said, Nada, is definitely something that startup founders should start looking into. I also feel on just before I move on, is understand the problem. I think when we speak to founders, when we're trying to solve these things in our head, because we've come out of corporate, you know, we think we know what the solution is, and we kind of go in tunnel vision to build straight away, because building is validation that you're doing something, right? You're building the Lego pieces, you can see the Lego, it's amazing. But the matter of fact is that you need to be speaking to your customer and understanding what the problem is first, before you can then go in and solve that problem. So really understanding that problem statement and then coming up with those different tactics, including growth, is definitely where I see how to really get the virality in your product going out. And on the last point, the cold start problem by Andrew Chen from A16Z has also been an invaluable book for anyone building a community's marketplace. It touches upon their efforts with their own startups, which have scaled, Clubhouse, Airbnb, amongst other well-known startups. And it really goes down into the nitty-gritty of how to create virality, network effects, and how to really growth hack in a very interesting way. I don't know, did you ever read that book by Andrew Chen?
Which one, sorry?
The Cold Start Problem.
No, I haven't.
It's an absolutely phenomenal book and definitely one that you should read. Nada, I want to ask you one question. And
sure.
You don't have to use Middle Eastern examples, but it would be preferred because obviously this podcast from the Middle East. Who has, from your opinion, and you can give the tool that they did used or a success story, which type of companies or which company that you've worked with has done growth hacking phenomenally well in the region, or a number of companies that you've worked with?
Oh, wow. I'll try not to be biased on this, but I think a lot of the people who've done the 10-day growth hacking challenge, a lot of them that have done well are people who are significantly growing in the region. And many different reasons for that. But ultimately is once they got educated and they understood how to use the growth thinking system, and they actually worked with me to implement it, they started actually to develop. So I had literally somebody who's head of growth at one of the major unicorns in the region, and he'd read my first book, and he reached out to me. He had some questions, and then he read it actually 4 times. And he said, like, I'm instituting that everybody should be reading this book in the organization because we have a huge organizational problem, which is what I was talking about earlier when it comes to structure for growth. And even although they're growing, he's like, we're stumped for growth, he said openly, because of the structure and some of the legacy that's there, even although they're still a relatively new company. So there's a wide variety of things, but within the challenge itself, we have a ton of examples. I mean, they're global, but we have a lot of people in the region as well who've done some pretty cool things. There's so many. I mean, I don't even know where to start. I mean, we both know obviously Kareem at ProTender. So he's been in the challenge. He's had some amazing results doing this. And you go through the list, we have just a ton of people who are just doing it all in different levels and different ways. And once it clicks and they get it, they just rock and roll. It just happens for them.
And in terms of trying to get access to your book, how do our listeners get access to your book? Are you on Audible, hard copy?
Yep. So I always recommend so for the yellow book, which is this one, you can do both digital, audio or print. I prefer print. Audio is not on Audible. It's on other audio platforms like Scribe. You'll find it almost on any other platform. And other formats. For this book, this is more or less like a workbook. So it has a lot of activities, and I recommend people to use pen and paper. It sounds kind of awkward in today's world, but there's a psychology behind pen and paper still till today. And so the best thing is you need to buy this in print. Some people, what they do is they buy this digitally to read the content, and then they get the print to actually use it. And there's 20 growth hacks in here. And you'll develop those 20, and it walks you through the whole system. And by the time you're done 20 growth hacks, you can move on to do several other things. So we have a lot of people that finish the book and then we move on. And then this becomes kind of like a growth hacking journal for them. And they're able to actually back map what had happened and then build on to the next one. And it keeps showing you step by step what to do. And in the 10-day growth hacking challenge, that's actually what we do live. So people binge watch, they kind of go, founders binge watch, investors, a lot of investors go on there to actually, you know, identify future potential investments. They sit and watch like how these founders of companies are able to think about growth, how they're able to solve problems, are they coachable? And there's all kinds of other things that go beyond just like a pitch deck, which happens in the 10-day growth hacking challenge. It gets investors really excited about what happens inside there, because investors are actually only after growth. Forget all the sophisticated stuff that they may tell you about, or you may tell them. At the end, the binding agent is growth. That's why you're there. That's why they're there. And that's what brings you together.
Yeah, I've got a great business opportunity for you. I'm thinking in my head, NADA as a service, the growth marketing specialist, NAS, right? We can whack up some advertising, throw you out there, because I think what you've said in this podcast has been invaluable. It's a great lesson to learn for us because, as I said, I'm not just a podcast host. I run two startups myself. I'm always looking for new ways of changing my behavior, my approach to problems. And over the last couple of conversations that we've had, you've done a lot, and I think we've just touched upon the surface of what you've done. I'd highly recommend people to read your books, to reach out to you for your program as well. Are you happy for people to reach out on LinkedIn, Nada?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they can reach out on LinkedIn or through my site or Instagram. I suggest for people to follow me on YouTube as well. There's a lot of content there that answers a lot of the questions people would probably end up asking me anyways. They're all there in detail through different tutorials, different interviews, and you'll just find a lot of it there. And it's beautiful part is it's free. The book is fairly inexpensive. So you can tap into a ton of resources that I've created before you ever need me to give you a bill. In very simple terms. Yeah, so many ways to do it. And then there's, of course, the growth hack that we did for today. I don't know if you want to share that with the audience, yeah. But I think like we ran the growth hack, right, to build some demand for this before people got on. And yeah.
It was a very interesting tool. So I think what we did was if we're doing a topic on growth hacking, you know, I'm experimenting as much as Nada, but we simply just created an event on LinkedIn, an event where you can actually publish the link at a later date. So we actually created excitement. I think in total, we had 115 people sign up before the event. Everyone, I think a day before and a couple of hours before the event got a notification before the podcast is going to be released, which is going to be in the next hour. And that really creates footfall and excitement to people who are tuning in on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is a great tool as a recruiter, as a founder, trying to meet people. I still love LinkedIn. It does a lot of great things amongst people sliding each other's DMs, which I don't like, but it is what it is. I think behavior needs to change, and that's why Wuster is coming into the market for this very reason. But Nada, thank you very much for your awesome. Time. Links to the books, to his YouTube channel, to all the resources that Nada has spoken about will be in the description link, so you don't need to rerun the recording. We'll have it all in the link for you, all actionable. And again, thank you for everyone who tuned in. Drop us a line on LinkedIn and just give us a thumbs up to if you liked the podcast. And again, Nada, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank
Take
you.
Take care, guys.
Thank you.
Bye. See you.